to it, the Daily Daily Caller podcast for this, the 30th day of May, 2019. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Please keep doing that. And as always, you can email me, derek@dailycaller.com. Compliments, complaints, threats, recipes, whatever you got. Normally, it's just me sitting alone in my basement with no pants, but covered in cats. Yes, sad but true. This time, it's a little different. I came into the office on Wednesday to do the Friday interview, and I see Chuck Ross roaming around. I said, Chuck, you got to come on. You got to talk about Mueller. So here joining me now is investigative journalist extraordinaire, Daily Caller's own Chuck Ross. How are you, Chuck?
Good, Derek. Good to be with you.
You picked the worst day of the year to come to Washington, D.C., to sweat to death.
I did. Actually, though, I'm from Kansas. I live in Kansas City.
Yeah.
A tornado touched down like 4 miles west of my house yesterday, and I haven't been, you know, I don't know if there's any damage, but I left that, came into the sweltering heat, so I don't know really which one is.
So God's out to get you.
Pretty much.
One way or another.
He's following me. Yeah,
he definitely will. Let's talk. You of course, have been following this and doing some stellar reporting on this from day one. This, in normal terms, would seem like the end. Mm-hmm. Mueller released the report. That would have been the natural end, but the left wouldn't let it die. Now he comes out, and he basically, in an 8-minute and change press conference, reiterates things that are in the report. What's weird about Mueller is he's like a Rorschach test. Whatever you see is what you get. And if you were inclined to be on the team Trump, you got what you needed. He said the same things and the report was conclusive. And if you are a team not Trump, never Trump, mm-hmm. Oh, he implied that he would have charged the president. When you're hearing about this, when you're seeing Mueller, when you hear about the way that he's playing this and the fact that he refuses, not refuses, but he doesn't want to testify. He doesn't want to answer any questions, refuses to take any questions at the press conference today. What goes through your mind knowing what you know and knowing the sources that you know and having done the reporting that you've done?
I was surprised at how little he said in that press conference.
Right.
Like you said, I mean, it was 8 minutes. He basically said, read the report, you know. And
right.
He said, if I was going to testify to Congress, I would basically read the report. So, like you said, I mean, it's not going to change anyone's opinion about the questions of obstruction and definitely not collusion, because he was pretty definitive on that point. What I think is interesting, I wonder how it will impact the impeachment, the drumbeat to impeachment.
Well, we saw Jerry Nadler come out and say, we need to go forward with this. Cory Booker said this, now I have to call for impeachment. It really was a grab bag where everybody could find what they wanted.
Right, right.
And it seemed to me that everybody came out of it with what they wanted.
Yeah, but if Mueller's not now going to testify, it seemed like the case for impeachment would have relied pretty heavily on some Mueller's testimony or some other additional piece of evidence that we haven't seen yet, beyond the report. And I think they were putting a lot on hoping that Mueller would come before Congress and, you know, go after Trump and explain why they could have brought an obstruction case, et cetera. But now, if he's not going to do that, I don't know what Democrats are going to use to keep that dream alive.
That's one of the things he said, was that charging the president was not an option. So they didn't draw a conclusion when it came to obstruction, which to me seems like a dodge. Mm-hmm. You can say we believe the president obstructed justice, but we can't charge him. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty definitive statement, unambiguous. But Mueller always seems to have lived during these 2 years in this gray area where he could go on. Anybody could see whatever he wanted, whatever they wanted to see. And he seemed to go out that way. Am I wrong in thinking that? Because Ken Starr was pretty unambiguous. Here's what Bill Clinton did. I'm not charging him with a crime or anything, but here's the crimes I believe he was guilty of. It's up to you to figure out what to do with that.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. It seems like he is playing that gray area. And I think in today's press conference, he said that, you know, he doesn't want to impugn someone who is not guilty of a crime. But
right.
Here we
but
have
then he did
a
it.
450-page report, plus there's a ton of innuendo in this, just giving the statement that he gave today that, you know, that Congress should look into some of these things. I mean, he's not accusing President Trump or anyone else of a crime at this point, because, well, as you said, you know, the law doesn't allow him to. But he's still putting it
out. But he could accuse him. Charging and accusing are two different things. And you could say, look, I can't bring an indictment for reasons X, Y, and Z, but I believe he did. We believe that by a preponderance of the evidence, we could prove in the court of law that he did these things. Then it's up to Congress. This, he wants to have his cake and eat it too. Exactly. Yeah. And then to, for him to say, I'm not going to be taking any questions. I don't want, if I am forced to testify, all I'll do is basically read the report. Mm-hmm. Like he'd sit there with a whole bunch of sticky tabs and a copy of the report and go and just read the relevant portions and not expand upon it. To my mind, I mean, you're a journalist, you have a natural desire to ask questions and get more information. I'm not. I'm an opinion guy. Proudly, they call me a journalist. I'll punch you in the nose. But I think Mueller has to testify at this point. I think he owes it to the American public to testify because he has been so nebulous, because he has been such living in these gray areas. I want to see what Jerry Nadler gets out of him, which will certainly be unfavorable to the president. But I also want to see what a Jim Jordan gets out of him. And have you ever heard of a witness say, hey, if you call me up to testify, I'll show up, but I'm not going to give you anything?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't think of anything off the top of my head that has put it the way he has. But I mean, you're right. Like both sides here want him to testify. And I'm the same way, just out of my own natural curiosity to know. We all want to know what actually
happened. The way he did the report, yes, there's a lot of stuff laid out there. But it's he never gets to a conclusion. He never gets to a point. I want to know why, one way or the other. There are a lot of things unanswered. And he seems content to almost arrogantly be the only one who knows.
Right, right.
And the only one who's ever going
to
know.
Right. I mean, we as the public, we have the right to know one way or the other, get some definitive answers on this, I believe. And, you know, I like you said, if Jim Jordan was leading the questioning, he would definitely go into the lack of collusion.
Right.
That's why this started. They started looking at collusion, and then the obstruction part was derivative of all of that. I mean, I want to know the core. I want to hear more about why – where the investigation failed to find collusion, why, like, and looking back into the origins of the investigation. I mean, whenever the report and Mueller says that they were unable to find, to establish that a conspiracy occurred, you know, it's very legalistic wording, but they're basically saying is that there was no collusion. But I would like to hear Mueller kind of say that in his own words, because a Democratic talking point is that, you know, Mueller is not saying that there was no collusion, he's just saying there was no conspiracy. You know, I like to hear him explain more about some of the what I believe are probably false leads on the collusion front that they looked down and that they were able to, basically remove, such as the Michael Cohen Prague trip, stuff from the dossier. I mean, I like to hear him walk through how that stuff, how they figured out it was wrong and then why that was so.
I want to know, and I think the American public deserves to know, and certainly people on the right want to know, when did he know there was no collusion, that was a dry well, and what took 2 years to figure that out, because it didn't seem like there was ever any moisture in that well they were digging. And I want to know what took so long and why we didn't find out until after the election, why it had to be couched in 200-ish pages in volume one about collusion when the origins of the investigation, and maybe there's something more, and this could help shed light on the Barr probe. Maybe there's more that justified the investigation before the appointment of Robert Mueller. But as of now, I, as a layman with basic knowledge of the law, can't see any rationale for spying on Americans, for spying on political opponents, and launching an investigation into something for which the only real evidence, at least that we know of to this point, is allegedly a guy bragging in a bar and a dossier, an opposition research file, commissioned by the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton. I would think Mueller would have some serious insights into all of those things, especially when he found out that there was nothing there. Yet we're never going to know if Mueller has his way.
Right. I mean, I that's one burning question I have in all this is when did Mueller know that there was not collusion? So if we back up, I think it was on the day that Mueller was appointed or the day after. There are these text messages from Peter Strzok, the infamous Peter Strzok, where he's saying he's hesitant to join the special counsel's team because he's afraid, which is just really weird, afraid that there's no big bear there. Those were his words. And by that, he meant he's afraid that there was actually no collusion, that they've been investigating. Which
is from a guy who was involved from day one.
Right, for 10 months.
Would have probably the most insight into that.
Yeah, and to me, that's a very telling, that's a contemporaneous thought of Peter Strzok, that there was no big there. So that probably means that they had looked at all these really salacious allegations about Trump and the campaign and found out there was. But then they found that they had that thought then, but then the investigation went on for another 2 years.
Right.
And most importantly, that investigation went beyond the 2018 midterms. You mm-hmm. know, I'm curious how we have no way of figuring it out, but how did that impact the outcome of the 2018 midterms?
One of the lead investigators says there's nothing here yet.
Yeah.
I want to know then what justified
right.
the investigation to begin with. And was there – I watch these Dateline things every once in a while. It's 2 hours of Keith Morrison talking about the boyfriend suddenly got suspicious. And then it turns out the boyfriend didn't do it. It was somebody else.
Right.
But you can go down a path and think, oh, there must be something down here. No, there's not. I want to know what those paths were and where they dead-ended. And I want to know, was there ever anything? And – it doesn't seem like the Democrats really want to know. They want the opposite of it. We had James Comey yesterday writing in the Washington Post, essentially saying the whole thing was dumb. It's stupid. How dare you investigate? But go ahead. Fine. He seems a little concerned that there might be something there. And your reporting, where do you see the Barr investigation with, is this Norton something or other? Up in Massachusetts, I can't remember.
It's John Durham in Connecticut.
Yeah, John Durham.
Somewhere up there.
Yeah, somewhere up in lower Canada, whatever.
I think one important part of appointing this inspector – well, first of all, we have an inspector general's
which is supposedly due out soon.
Soon. I mean, we'd heard end of this month or next month probably. But inspector generals are limited in what they can do.
And they can't charge anybody.
They can't charge. They can't impanel a grand jury. They can't issue subpoenas. They have very little, unless someone wants to volunteer from outside the FBI or just, you know, they can't compel someone not in those agencies to testify or to speak with them. So a U.S. attorney, the benefit of that is you can compel those things. And so we know that Barr is also looking at CIA activities and other agencies' activities leading up to that. As far as where it goes, you know, I don't know. I think that there are a ton of questions that remain unanswered. That's a kind of a simple, obvious point. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the narrative that the FBI has put out is that the investigation started at the end of July 2016. That's just not true. I mean, maybe they wrote the piece of paper that formally opened it, but there were activities going on before that. We had Stefan Halper, the FBI informant, who was meeting with Carter Page several weeks before that. We have John Brennan, who has testified that, you know, he was
– we can't take his testimony seriously.
Right. True. In general, yeah, he's all over the place. But I guess he has slightly acknowledged that there were – he was looking at things earlier in 2016. So what were those? What intelligence had he received? Durham is going to look at that. I'm not like anything. I'm not going to get my hopes up too high that something major will come out of it, because the government, the agencies, the bureaucracy has a way of, you know, reining things in and keeping themselves obviously protected. So we'll see how it plays out.
I walked past a bank of TVs after I went out and got you in the office, and it was wall to wall. They're still talking about. And 2 hours before Mueller's press conference, they were wildly speculating about what Mueller might say. Mm-hmm. Then 8 minutes of Mueller, and then hours and hours of more. Mueller said this, and it's again, finding what they want. We've not seen anything close to this amount of coverage when it comes to what Durham is doing, what Barr is talking about. As soon as Barr opened his mouth and said the word spying, it was, how dare he?
Right.
It's an outrage. It's electronic surveillance without the knowledge of the target. Is there anybody out there? Are you surprised? Probably not. But are you surprised at the lack of curiosity? When Donald Trump when the White House announced that Donald Trump had granted the Attorney General the authority to declassify information related to the origins of this investigation. Normally, journalists go, good, more information.
Right.
It is my job to gather information. the government giving it to me is going to make that that much easier. Instead, it was, can you believe what the president is doing? Mm-hmm. Can't believe they're declassifying these things. What is your response to watching this? Because you've been the target of scorn by left-wing journalists for your reporting, which has proven to be true. And they've ignored. And then when they can no longer ignore it, they quickly report it, don't cite you, and then move on and say, I've already covered that. It's old news. Right. So as you watch this unfold, which could be a treasure, it could be a dead end too, mm-hmm. but it could be a treasure trove of government abuses of power and possible corruption, the likes of which this country has never seen. The disinterest mm-hmm. in the media, the possibility of even looking into this. What do you think when you see that?
Yeah, it's really bizarre. I mean, it's just crazy to me that there are not more reporters just chomping at the bit, wanting this information. I mean, from my perspective, I want any and all of the information. Mm-hmm. You know, if I could see the Mueller grand jury information that is, you know, it's illegal to release that. I would love to see that stuff just for my own curiosity, but also because I think journalists have a duty to get information out there, and we should want that information out there. But yeah, I mean, so my perspective of watching the declassification on Thursday, that order, my observation, I don't know, I was watching TV, like CNN, MSNBC to check in to see how they're responding. It's definitely muted. You know, mm-hmm. the journalists weren't exactly excited about it. The pundits, of course, thought it was going to be the end of the world and that all these outrage. Sources are going to be
violating, threatening sources and methods.
Yeah. Outrage. I mean, and so as far as that, like there should be more pushback from journalists on that talking point that has emerged. I mean, maybe they don't want to go. I don't know. I don't know how individual journalists should handle that story, but there's not been any pushback from the journalists on that insane talking point that Barr or Trump are going to start releasing sources and methods. That's just not going to happen. And the irony of it all is that, you know, people like John Brennan have been really rallying around that talking point. But if you look at so many of the stories that so many reports about actual sources and methods throughout the Russia investigation have been leaked to the same news, Washington Post, yes. New York Times. The identity sources have been confirmed to these newspapers. The existence of a FISA warrant against Carter Page was leaked to the Washington Post. Developments as far as before Trump's inauguration, there were reports about surveillance picking up interaction or conversations between Russians and Trump associates. So all of these things and the existence of the Alexander Downer part with Papadopoulos was leaked to the New York Times. We don't know who the leakers are, but it's obviously someone who's not a fan of Trump within the government who's leaking this information. So for them to now turn around and claim that it's going to be a disaster to start talking about these things, doing it illegal way.
It also assumes the worst about the attorney general, that he would look at something and his advisors would say, if you release this information right here in this paragraph, that could put people's lives at risk. Yeah. That would, and he would just go, to hell with it. Put it out there. Let the chips fall where they may. No, there's no evidence to suggest right. he would do anything of the sort.
But they've done an excellent job. And I'm not saying it's a conscious effort
I
on
am.
The part.
Well, you I will. Believe it is.
It could. Well, I guess in the sense of, I don't know if Democrats and certain journalists sat down as, I don't think well, they actually
a hive
sat
mind doesn't have to have a get
exactly.
together.
I was going to get it. Yeah, it's a hive mind mentality. So I guess I'm being a little charitable. But whatever the case may be, they've spent 2 months smearing Barr, priming him as this, you know, gung-ho guy who's going to cover for Trump.
Yeah, that's all he's doing.
I mean, and so now they get to just point back to that from 2 months ago and say, see, look, he's doing exactly what we predicted he would do, even though all he's really doing, honestly, is just
providing more information exactly. to people. And the people whose job it is to get more information are outraged at the concept. I can't believe it. Anything else we should know before we let you go and I get on with the rest of the show?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, no, I don't have anything else.
Riveting at the end there. Chuck, thanks for stopping by. And when you hear my voice again, I'll be back in my basement. Okay, I'm back home now. But when you know, it's a different kind of podcast, but hell, there are no rules to this podcast. And you run into Chuck Ross. When you run into Chuck Ross, you talk to Chuck Ross. That's all there is to it. And I happen to be there filming for tomorrow's show, the interview. You're going to really find that interesting. Former CIA counter
terrorism analyst, did a documentary on Mosul and the fight against ISIS. And we had a really, really interesting chat. You'll hear that on tomorrow's program. And then Chuck Ross was there, and he doesn't live here. So I was like, hey, Chuck, let's talk. Got his reaction to the Mueller speech. Now I'm home. It's the middle of the night. I'm denying myself sleep. So let's get back into that a little bit. And all the other news of the day as a cat sleeps over my shoulder. I'm jealous of you, Veruca. Okay. So Mueller's statement, it really just undercuts. First of all, he basically reiterated what he'd said in his report. So I'm not really sure what the purpose of the statement was, except for one important difference. He said that's about it. You're going to hear from him. He doesn't want to talk about it anymore. For my money, and it is my money, it's your money, the money that was spent on Robert Mueller's investigation, that's not how this stuff works. There are unanswered questions, and he doesn't want to answer them. That was abundantly clear. This, near the end of his statement, lays out his, is his Eric Cartman moment. Screw you guys, I'm going home. I'm taking my ball and I'm going home, and I'm not going to be accountable for anything. That's not how it's supposed to work. Let's listen to Mueller make that very point.
Now, I hope and expect this to be the only time that I will speak to you in this manner. I am making that decision myself. No one has told me whether I can or should testify or speak further about this matter. There has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report. It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We chose those words carefully, and the work speaks for itself. And the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before us. In addition, access to our underlying work product is being decided in a process that does not involve our office. So beyond what I've said here today and what is contained in our written work, I do not believe it is appropriate for me to speak further about the investigation or to comment on the actions of the Justice Department or Congress. And it's for that reason I will not be taking questions today as well.
Screw you guys. I'm going home.
That's not how this works, Bob. I understand you don't want to go up there and testify. You said, according to reports a couple of weeks ago, you were apprehensive because you didn't want to appear political. You want to appear above the fray. Well, you work for the public, and you are accountable to the public. And there are a lot of questions. I know that there are a lot of Democrats who would love to ask you to expand upon certain things. And I know there are a lot of Republicans who would love to ask you about how you came to various conclusions. That's part of the deal when you take a job in the federal government, is you are supposed to be accountable. You're supposed to answer some questions. But I'll tell you, why I think that Democrats are now not going to want Robert Mueller to testify. As much as they would like to have their questions answered and get the sound bites generated from asking him those questions, they also recognize that if Democrats are allowed to ask Robert Mueller questions, Republicans will be able to ask Robert Mueller questions. And at this point, the Democrats already have what they want from Robert Mueller. They have him on camera, on video, basically saying that I couldn't charge the president. I didn't make a determination because I'm not allowed to charge a president. That's what they wanted to say. They want the implied obstruction of justice, and the only thing that saved Donald Trump from an indictment was the fact that he's president, and the Office of Legal Counsel made guidelines that said that you cannot indict a sitting president. Guidelines, by the way, not a rule. Guidelines. That means it can be overruled. If he had come up with a compelling case for obstruction of justice, there is no doubt in anybody's mind that if he had presented that to the Attorney General and it was a convincing case, that they would have gone forward with it. No question. They might not have, you know, acted on it. It might have remained sealed until after the term or terms of any given president. But they didn't do that. Robert Mueller didn't do that. See, here's the thing. While the guidelines are that indicting a sitting president is not allowed, just guidelines, not a rule, not a hard and fast rule, there was and is nothing preventing Robert Mueller from saying, hey, you know what? We found all kinds of evidence of obstruction of justice. And if we had had our druthers, if we had had our ability, if we'd had our way, we would have charged the president with obstruction of justice. But for this Office of Legal Counsel ruling, we are not able to do so. There is nothing in statute, in regulation, in rule, that would have prevented Robert Mueller from including that, from saying that in his report, or saying it today, yesterday. He did not. He did not say anything. He went to great lengths to make sure that the American public knew that the people who were indicted, mostly Russians, who will never face justice, by the way, have the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. And then he went on to essentially say the exact opposite about the President of the United States. That's not how our justice system works. Democrats love to run around saying, you know, the president, no American, not even the president of the United States, is above the law. Well, no American, not even the president of the United States, is below the law either. Yet that's the standard that Democrats have set for anybody who is not a bona fide liberal and fully on their team. Brett Kavanaugh, during his confirmation hearing, he was not innocent until proven guilty. Democrats demanded that he prove himself innocent. Robert Mueller seemed to have the same standard for the President of the United States. We could not, if we had been able to find proof that the President had not committed a crime, we would have included that in our report. Well, that wasn't your job, Bob. That wasn't your job at all. That's not the job of any prosecutor anywhere in the country. That is taking our justice system and flipping it on its head. Imagine being charged and say, okay, now we've accused you of murder. Go ahead and prove you didn't do it. Otherwise, you're going to jail. Well, nobody would stand for that. But even Democrats wouldn't stand for that. They want to let everybody out of prison. But when it comes to politics, well, that's a different story. Democrats don't care about due process. They don't care about the presumption of innocence that was fully on display during the Kavanaugh hearings, and it remains true today. What's shocking is that Robert Mueller decided to adopt that policy as well. And it's not just me saying that. By the way, if you remember back to the 90s during the Clinton impeachment hearings. I was on WOR last night in New York on the radio with Lise Wheel and Joe Concha, friend of the show here. And they were I was talking about this very subject, and Lise Wheel, who's the Democrat on there, asked me about the fact that Mueller could have said, you know, the president, we have ample proof that the president obstructed justice, but we're not allowed to charge him. And I reminded her and the audience of the 90s, the Ken Starr report. Ken Starr laid out, I think it was 11 different charges that President Bill Clinton had broken the law. He didn't indict the president. He said, you know, here's the proof. Here's what we believe. The president broke this law, this law, this law, and here's the proof behind it. It's up to you guys to do with it what you will. And Lise pointed out that, well, he was an independent counsel rather than a special counsel. And that's true. The independent counsel reported to Congress. The special counsel reports to the Attorney General. The regulations, the rules that created the independent counsel, and this gets a little wonky, but stick with me. I think I can make it clear pretty easily. The special counsel reports to one person and one person only, and that's the Attorney General. and the report is written for the Attorney General. It is a confidential report for the Attorney General that can be acted upon by whoever the Attorney General happens to be who gets a report from the independent counsel. Bill Barr, the Attorney General, was under no obligation to release that report and would have been 100% legally justified in refusing to release any findings from the report. He could have just put out his four-page statement right the weekend that it came out and said, that's it. You know, this report is for me. It's going to stay confidential. Good luck with you guys. Moving on. He didn't. Again, erring on the side of transparency. But the difference between what Ken Starr did, while their mandates were different, and what Robert Mueller did, should not be lost. Ken Starr laid out a case and drew conclusions. That is the job of these investigators. What comes of those conclusions is the job of politicians, political appointees, or others in the judicial system. Robert Mueller wasn't going to take the president to court. He was working for the Attorney General. Ken Starr said, here you go, Congress. Here's what I believe in. Congress then acted. Robert Mueller said, this could have happened. This might have happened. I'm not going to draw any conclusions. I'm going to leave it up to the Attorney General. He was not, in fact, as Democrats say, all throughout the media, writing this report with a wink and a nod to Congress. Chuck Todd is running around. He's clearly laid this on the foot of Congress to make this determination. That's what he was doing. He was unable to make this case himself. Therefore, he was laying this out for Congress to act as it should. Well, no. The report was written explicitly for the Attorney General. Therefore, he was writing the report for the Attorney General unless he was acting in a political manner. He wouldn't do that, would he? He is, above reproach. He is beyond reproach. Chuck Todd tweeted, Mueller basically reiterated what seemed clear to those who read, and he put read in all caps, read the report. This decision belongs to Congress and only Congress. Chuck Todd is advocating just basically taking the Justice Department, telling them, screw you guys, I'm going home. Get bent. Get out of the way. But the Justice Department matters. The Attorney General matters. The report was written explicitly for the Attorney General, as I've said many times. You can't cut him out. The ultimate determination of whether or not there was any crime of obstruction of justice was left to the Attorney General, and that determination was made. It was made by committee, including Rod Rosenstein, who is no fan of the President of the United States. But Robert Mueller did his job. He did what Democrats wanted him to do before Congress, and he did it without any cross-examination. He did it without ever having to ask, when did you discover there was no collusion? There was no collusion at all with the Trump campaign in Russia. When did you come to that determination? And then why did the investigation not stop at that point? Why did that not stop then? That's when this should have stopped. That was your mandate. When it came to determining whether or not the president obstructed justice, you chose not to draw any conclusion whatsoever, yet it was your job to draw conclusions. If you were not willing to do your job, or if you saw this Office of Legal Counsel guideline as preventing you from fully doing your job, then why did you do any of the job at all? If you were not going to make a conclusion and you made this determination from the get-go, why do it? Was it just so you could hammer checks? Did you just want to gather intel and opposition research for Democrats? The fact that there is no Russian collusion seems pretty transparent and was pretty easily determined. Did you determine that before the 2018 midterm elections? If you did, why did you not then release the report at that point, or at least an interim report? Why did you wait until after? Why did you allow this cloud to hang over this administration? You were clearly aware of all of the news reporting and the constant drumbeat, including a whole bunch of fake stories that you remained mostly silent for, that may well have been sourced from your office. Why did you choose to do that? These are the types of questions Robert Mueller doesn't want to have to answer, and these are the types of questions that Democrats, now especially, don't want Robert Mueller to have to answer, because there really is no good answer. If your job is to determine whether or not a bank was robbed, and you go in there and all the money is there, you know right away the bank was not robbed. You can determine that pretty quickly. You wouldn't then say, I'm going to need 6 months to determine this. We're going to have to thoroughly interview every single employee and every patron that was in the bank at that time. The Russian collusion garbage hoax was readily apparent that it didn't happen. It was obvious that it didn't happen. That was determined pretty quickly, I suspect. Why did Mueller then last 2 years on this investigation? We don't know. And if Robert Mueller has his way, we'll never know. And now I suspect Democrats will never, ever, ever subpoena him. Because when you're subpoenaed and you go before Congress and you show up, you have really two options. You answer the questions given to you, or you plead the Fifth Amendment if you believe that you will be violating your right against self-incrimination. You don't get to apply the Fifth Amendment willy-nilly. You can't take some questions and then say, well, that question I'm not going to answer because of my Fifth Amendment, but the second part of your question, let me tell you a thing or two. Once you start answering questions, you waive your Fifth Amendment privilege on any and all questions. That's why there's a lot of footage. Democrats are much better at this than Republicans, because Republicans are stupid when it comes to messaging. That's why there's a lot of footage of, say, Oliver North during the Iran-Contra hearings, repeatedly, over and over, after question, saying, at the advice of counsel, I assert my Fifth Amendment privilege. And Democrats just kept asking him question after question after question. They knew they were only going to get that answer from him, but they wanted the video of him answering that way to every question they had. Republicans go, when they were in control of the House, they said, well, they're just going to plead the Fifth. We're not even going to bother really pressing Lois Lerner. We're going to dismiss this hearing after about 5 minutes and move on. It would have been so much better to ask her basic questions and have her refuse to answer and use that to show just how deep this conspiracy against conservatives went in the Trump or the Obama administration. But they don't have the will for that. They don't have the brains for that. They're terrible. So Robert Mueller, actually, though, would have zero justification for pleading the Fifth Amendment in any testimony before Congress. He said in that clip I played you, my answers would not go beyond anything written in the report. So he would, have a bunch of sticky tabs sticking out of the Mueller report, and every question anybody asked, he'd go and read that, or he would say, I'm not going to answer that. I'm not going to answer that is not an option for a government employee. It's not the way. It's none of your damn business. They ask him, what's your wife? Is she clean? Does she clean the bathroom, or is she messy in the bathroom? You could say that's none of your damn business. But when it comes to your official duties and there's no claim of privilege, no need for privilege, there is no, I'm not going to answer that. So these questions will likely remain unanswered. And Democrats now have the footage they want. It's not just me saying this, by the way. It's not just me being critical. You're a partisan right-winger. Yeah, I am. I'm open about it. I'm perfectly straightforward about this. It's Alan Dershowitz, who is definitely not a partisan right-winger. In the Hill newspaper, he wrote a piece yesterday entitled Shame on Robert Mueller for Exceeding His Role. And he makes a very interesting point. Professor Dershowitz writes, the statement by special counsel Robert Mueller in a Wednesday press conference that, quote, if we had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said that, end quote, is worse than the statement made by then FBI Director James Comey regarding Hillary Clinton during the 2016 presidential campaign. Comey declared in a 2016 press conference that although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information, end quote. Comey was universally criticized, blah, 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 he says, and then he continues because Dershowitz had been kind of a defender of Mueller. Until today, he writes, I have defended Mueller against the accusations that he is a partisan. I did not believe that he personally favored either the Democrats or the Republicans or had a point of view on whether President Trump should be impeached. But I have now changed my mind. By putting his thumb, indeed his elbow, on the scale of justice in favor of impeachment based on obstruction of justice, Mueller has revealed his partisan bias. He has also distorted the critical role of a prosecutor in our justice system. Dershowitz, liberal Democrat, has been ostracized in the Hamptons, according to reports, is sticking to his guns here. He continues, virtually everybody agrees that in a normal case, a prosecutor should never go beyond publicly disclosing that there is insufficient evidence to indict. No responsible prosecutor should ever suggest that the subject of his investigation might indeed be guilty if there was insufficient evidence or other reasons not to indict. Supporters of Mueller will argue that this is not an ordinary case, that he is not an ordinary prosecutor, and that President Trump is not an ordinary subject of an investigation. They are wrong. The rules should not be any different. He goes on from there, but that's the gist of it. And that's exactly what Robert Mueller did. That is why he will likely not be called to testify. He came out and gave vocalization to the parts of the Mueller report that the Democratic media has been focusing on and obsessing on. There's no need to bring him up. Whatever good could be gained by getting him to expand on that would be undercut and indeed kneecapped by having Republicans able to question him and find out the rationale for other decisions that his office made that were bad. Democrats, I don't think, are willing to risk that. That's why I'd like to see someone like Lindsey Graham in the United States Senate subpoena Robert Mueller. Say, you know, it's really sweet and nice that you don't want to come up here and testify, but we've got some questions for you. And since you did this for the people of the United States, come up and answer some questions. And I'd like to see Robert Mueller face some tough questioning. I don't know whether anybody will do it. The Senate is very collegial and very friendly and very worried about appearances. The House is more partisan, but Nadler will likely not call up Mueller to testify. Mueller, to call this a press conference, by the way, is an abuse of the language. That was not a press conference yesterday. A press conference is you make a statement or you just take questions from the press, but after you make your statement, you then take questions from the press. Robert Mueller refused to take any questions from the press. He refused to take any questions from anybody. He doesn't have to take questions from the press, but to use the term press conference is ridiculous. He read a statement. He read it kind of fumblingly, too. I'm not really sure that he is the super genius or maybe not all there anymore, but I imagine that would be part of why he doesn't want to answer questions at a public hearing or even in a private hearing. The transcript would eventually come out, and he might be exposed as kind of a detached boss. There were a lot of reports that Mueller was more of an absentee landlord than he was a leader of this investigation. We shall see. I hope somebody has the testicular fortitude, because there's a lot of press or push right now up on the Hill. Don McGahn, president's, you know, the legal counsel of the president, he has to come and testify, and Gerald Nadler subpoenaed him. And McGahn did not show up, and there was outrage. Should we hold McGahn in contempt? Well, if you want to ask anybody anything, you should start first and foremost with the person who has all the information. If Democrats don't call Robert Mueller and Robert Mueller is not forthcoming, then what business would you have asking somebody else a bunch of questions? Don McGahn testified and talked to Mueller's people for 30 hours. Shouldn't you then, if you're going to ask McGahn questions, you should first talk to Robert Mueller and say, hey, was there anything, you know, that you didn't think he was particularly honest about, anything we should recover, anything we should dig deeper into, or anything like that? It should start at first with the person who did the investigating, but they don't want that. They can't do that. Again, it probably will not happen because the narrative was already fed. And speaking of feeding narratives, there was another ridiculous story that broke yesterday. I just didn't believe this when I first saw it. It's up on Drudge. It involves John McCain, the USS John McCain, a naval warship. The Wall Street Journal has the story. The headline, White House wanted USS John McCain out of sight during Trump Japan visit. Because the story is, Donald Trump so hates John McCain still that he couldn't even stand the idea of a naval ship bearing his name being seen by him. He would have been so triggered. The story written by Rebecca Ballhaus and Gordon Lubold. The White House wanted the USS Navy to move out of sight the warship USS John S. McCain ahead of President Trump's visit to Japan, according to an email reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. The ship was named after the father and grandfather of the late senator, a war hero who became a frequent target of Mr. Trump's ire. And the senator's name was added to the ship in 2018. Yes, John McCain was a frequent target of Trump's ire, mostly because Donald Trump was a frequent target of McCain's ire, but they leave that out. Says in a May 15th email to U.S. Navy and Air Force officials, a U.S. Indo-Pacific Command official outlined plans for the president's arrival that he said had resulted from conversations between the White House military office and the 7th Fleet of the U.S. Navy, in addition to instructions for the proper landing areas for helicopters and preparations for the USS Wasp, there where the president was scheduled to speak, the official issued a third directive. Quote, USS John McCain needs to be out of sight. Well, this, of course, the liberal media pounced on. Look at how petty Donald Trump is. He's such a snowflake that he would be triggered by the existence of this ship named after John McCain. And the narrative just writes itself. Well, in the story in the Wall Street Journal, there's a picture of the USS John McCain, and it is has the name covered up with a tarp. And this was an example. They couldn't disappear the ship. They were too far away from the Bermuda Triangle, apparently. But they needed to cover up the name of the ship because Donald Trump would then uncontrollably vomit. Well, the president denied this because it's ridiculous and childish. The White House officially denied this because it's childish. The Navy denied this because it's childish. And then later on in the evening, 8:45 to be exact, surprisingly, the source for this is NBC News. Katie Turd quoted or tweeted this, quoting Courtney Cube with a K, K-U-B-E, who is, she's an NBC correspondent covering national security in the Pentagon. Katie Turd tweeted, per Katie Cube, a spokesperson for the U.S. Pacific Fleet said the picture of the tarp is from Friday and it was taken down on Saturday. So the Wall Street Journal ran a photograph with their article showing the ship's name covered with a tarp. Oh my goodness, can you believe this? Look at how they couldn't disappear the ship, so they disappeared the name. That petty, childish Donald Trump narrative fully met, satiated, and then it turns out to be garbage. Quote, according to the Navy spokesman, quote, all ships remained in normal configuration during President Trump's visit. Huh. Weird. Another story that turns out to be garbage, but it was reported unquestioningly. And I know if you're sitting there and you're probably like me a few years ago, and you think the Wall Street Journal, well, that's conservative. So is this really just a screw up on behalf of the Wall Street Journal? But actually, surprisingly, studies of journalism, the stories, not the editorial board, have found that the news in the Wall Street Journal is actually fairly liberal. One of the most liberal. It was named, I think it was Columbia School of Journalism or whatever. I can't remember which one it was, but it definitely wasn't like Media Research Center. Found that the reporting in the Wall Street Journal was very, very liberally biased. The editorial page and the editorial board is conservative. There's no question about that. They make no qualms about that. But as it used to be in newspapers, there is a wall between the editorial side and the news side. When I first started at the Daily Caller, I was the very first person hired. And I was eventually, when we started to get around to building a website before there even was a website, I was assigned the position of being the opinion editor. My official title was like managing editor or something like that. I forget what it was, but I was going to be in charge of opinion. And they were ramping up to the launch. I ended up leaving just before the launch. But ramping up to the launch, there were daily meetings, editorial meetings. And some of the journalists there at the very beginning of the Daily Caller were uncomfortable that I was there, that I was at the editorial meeting. I was opinion. I should not be there. I had no problem with it, as I didn't have anything to say about what they were doing because it wasn't my job. That used to be pretty standard in the journalism business. When you are opinion, you don't mix with news. And when you're news, you don't mix with opinion. And you're not like Sharks and Jets, where if you end up in the same elevator, there's going to be a rumble or anything like that. But it was, you know, you do your thing, we'll do our thing. Don't worry about what we're doing. We're not going to worry about what you're doing. It's not that way anymore. The editorial page of the New York Times, for example, sets the tone of their coverage. It sets the attitude of their reporters. You'd be hard-pressed to tell the difference between a news story and an opinion story in the pages of the New York Times. That's just how things are. But the Wall Street Journal is very different. They run it old school. Opinion is opinion, and news is news. And news, even at the Wall Street Journal, is liberal. They got this story completely wrong. There's still not a retraction at this point or even a correction, but we'll see if they ever get around to doing that. As we approach the end of the program today, I want to talk a little bit about the Democratic field. They've all now pretty much universally called for the impeachment of the president, which is going to help them in the, well, it's not really going to help them in the primary. They have to do it. It's a requirement in the primary if they want any kind of viability. It won't help them in the general election. But they are looking at a debate. We're less than a month away from the first Democratic debate, if you can believe that. It's coming up, I think, June 26th and 27th. Two nights only. Two panels of probably about 10 people arguing with each other about their sameness. You can't really differentiate yourself. It's going to be a debate about biography. And it's going to be a waste of time, because much like the Republican debates last time, when you got 10 people on a stage, nobody gets to speak. It's an hour and a half, even if it's a two-hour debate. You divide that down with commercial time, you cut out, you get maybe an hour and a half, being generous. If it's a two-hour debate, I don't know how long these are, but if it's a two-hour debate, you got an hour and a half, being generous, after commercials. Then you divide 90 minutes by 10 people. You're looking that if everything were divided equally amongst the 10 participants in each night, you got maybe 9 minutes. what kind of point can you make in 9 minutes? It's not 9 minutes of giving a speech. It is, here's a question, you have 90 seconds or 2 minutes or a minute or whatever it is to answer. And then if you mention anybody else's name, you will then they will then be able to rebut it. They're not going to attack anybody, so they're probably going to be too busy trying to get their recognition up that they're not going to mention anybody else except for maybe attacking the front runners. So what kind of question is John Hickenlooper going to get if he makes the debate stage? Probably not too much, not too serious a question, and nobody really gives a damn what John Hickenlooper has to say to begin with. So the Democrats have a bit of a problem. They have more people running for president than any party ever has before. So in future debates, they're looking at raising the bar. This could weed out the herd pretty quickly. Politico has the story under the headline, Dems chafe at high bar to make DNC presidential debates. You've got right now, to get into the first two debates, you have to have at least 1% in one of, you know, a legitimate national poll and 65,000 donors. That's a pretty low bar, 1%. The only people who aren't meeting it yet are Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, who really thought she stood a chance, and someone like a, what's-his-face? Eric Swalwell, the worthless, dumb California congressman. I don't know what the hell he was thinking. Well, they're raising that bar for the second round of debates. You have to have at least 2% and $130,000 individual donors in order to make the debate. 130,000 individual donors is an incredibly high bar. 65,000 donors, you think about it, seems like a low bar in a nation of 330 million people, but 65,000 donors amongst 24, 25, however many there are candidates, of the people who are inclined to give to Democrats, there's going to have to be a lot of double dipping in there. So they're very upset that now that they're doubling these standards, essentially, they're doubling them. What I would like to see, and this is a little bit political dirty tricksterness, but because what they're counting on is, since Democrats, many of the Democrats running for president won't meet that threshold, polling 2% and 130,000 donors is a much higher bar than what it was. They're counting on a lot of people dropping out. They want to weed the herd before anybody has a chance to vote. In many ways, it's the DNC deciding again, like they did in 2016, where they rigged it so that Hillary would win. They sort of screwed Bernie over at every chance they could possibly get, scheduling debates like up against the Super Bowl or whatever it was. They were just trying to find any way possible to make the debates unappealing to the American public, especially the voting Democrats, because the more people saw of Hillary, the less they liked of Hillary, and that included Democrats, which is why Bernie got stronger as the race went on. They want to, the party establishment, the party of the people, by the way, the party that chants, this is what democracy looks like. They want to decide which choices are to be made. You can have any candidate you want from this pre-approved list of candidates. Now, when I sit down and on Saturdays for movie night with the wife, I generally let her pick the movie. But I do let her, it's a joint, we're married, we're not a political party. I say, you can pick from any of these two or three movies. Which one do you want to watch? And then we watch it. There's a very good reason I do that. When I've given her the choice of which movie to watch, just free reign, she's picked some god-awful, terrible movies. Really embarrassing. One time we rented Bruno, which after Borat, we thought, oh, well, Sacha Baron Cohen, it'll be good. And The Dictator's really funny, too. So we watched Bruno, and we didn't even finish it. It was just dumb. It was just, I guess, the shtick kind of wore thin. But she's made other bad choices, too. Plus, when left to her own devices, she'll watch, like, The Notebook or something, and that's not going to be an option. But the Democratic Party is trying to work that way as well with their voters. We're going to eliminate as many of the riffraff as possible so that we can make sure that our candidate is not damaged by somebody trying to make a name for themselves. The last thing they want is an Eric Swalwell or an Andrew Young or even a Pete Buttigieg attacking a Joe Biden. Joe Biden right now is the golden boy. He's the presumptive nominee at this point. They're already measuring him for a crown. They don't want him damaged in the primary season, but they have to pretend that there's a primary season, that they're really taking this very seriously, and it's up to the voters and the will of the voters, but they're going to ever increase the number required to get up on the debate stage. And this is where I come in. I am not somebody who would ever advocate for giving money to a politician, Republican or Democrat. If you want to do that, that's absolutely fine. It's your money. I don't want to tell anybody how to spend it. But if some people are getting close, some of the also-rans are getting close, we might want to consider donating a dollar, because you really only have to donate a dollar to count in that 130,000 unique donor list. Donate a dollar to, if Eric Swalwell, God forbid, please get him on the debate stage. If Eric Swalwell gets close, if he's got 100,000 donors, but he's not going to make it over that finish line, conservatives need to consider throwing him a buck. Throwing him a buck just for the hell of it, just to get him up on that debate stage. The more clowns that are piled up on that stage, the better off it is for Republicans. Not just Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, but Republicans across the board. I want to see as many of them make as many of the debates as humanly possible, because I want the American people to know not only what the Democratic nominee stands for, I want them to see how crazy the Democratic Party has become. So we're not there yet. We're still months away. Or a couple of months away, anyway. But I would like to keep that in mind, that maybe, just maybe, we have a little Operation Chaos of our own, you know, in 2020 style, unlike 2016, and see if we can't crowd up that debate stage with these lunatic leftists spewing their bile, their hatred, and their insanity, so that the world gets to see what the choices are. That's the best way to win, is to differentiate yourself from your opponent. And it wouldn't even require Donald Trump to do anything, or Republicans in general to do anything. Plus, the more craziness that comes about on that debate stage, the more the candidates down the ticket will have to answer for. If an Eric Swalwell or a Marianne Williamson or whatever, there's a spiritual guru who's apparently pretty famous, although I never heard of her, who's going to make the first debate. When she says something crazy, or Elizabeth Warren talks about forgiving all student loan debt, well, whoever's running for Congress in your district, whoever's running for mayor of your town or senator or governor or whatever, around, if they're a Democrat, there's a possibility, it's slimmer than it would be if it were a Republican, but there's a possibility that they will be asked, do you support the idea of taking on $1 trillion+ in new debt by forgiving people who irresponsibly took out massive loans to get a bachelor's degree in an unusable field? Could have damage down the ticket. Whether or not it will remains to be seen. But the more information out there and the more the American people see these people, I think the better off it will be for Republicans. So maybe, just maybe, start saving your pennies and give two rolls of pennies to every Democrat on the cusp to push them over the edge. Crowd that stage. Make it look like Bellevue just opened up their doors. I think Bellevue. Bellevue, the insane asylum? I think it is. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, an interview with documentary filmmaker about Mosul, former CIA guy, plus all the news of the day, as we always do every Friday. Thank you for listening. Email me, Derek@dailycaller.com, and be happy. Today's Thursday. That means tomorrow is Friday. We'll see you then.
Screw you guys. I'm going home.